are listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 LPFM. My name is Steve Niebel, and I'm your host today. I'm sitting in for David Gilmore, who is on hiatus. Today we have Michael Daly, born and raised in Dorchester, Massachusetts. He joined a religious order as a teenager and prepared to become a Catholic priest. His early writing was inspired by attending poetry readings of Allen Ginsberg, Diane de Prima, John Updike, W.H. Auden, Yevgeny Yevtushenko, Gary Snyder, and Denise Levertov, among others. In 1990, he received an MFA from the University of Washington, where he studied with Heather McHugh. He founded Empty Bowl Press in 1976 and published Dalmo Anthologies with work by William Stafford, Sam Hamill, Carolyn Forsch, Barry Lopez, John Haynes, Tom Jay, Judith Roche, Robert Sund, Jim Hanen, Sharon Dubiago, Bill O'Daly, Mahmoud Darvish, Ernesto Cardinal, and many other poets and essayists. He was a founding member of the Skagit River Poetry Festival and has been a featured presenter there several times. As a translator, he served on panels with Coleman Banks, Heather McHugh, Mike O'Connor, Robert Sund, Michael McGriff, and Robert Haas. His reviews and essays have appeared in Pacific Northwest Review of Books, Raven Chronicles, and Bookmark Quarterly Review, and elsewhere. In 2017, he once again became editor-publisher of Empty Bowl Press and also curates poetry readings at Pelican Bay Books, introducing such poets to his community as Bill Porter, Paul Hunter, Ed Harkness, Alice Hokinson, Bill Ransom, Jessica Gigot, Tess Gallagher, Alice Derry, Rena Priest, Sam Green, Elizabeth Austin, Clemens Stark, Tim McNulty, and many others. In 2022, Telemachus, Mr. Daly's first novel, will be published by Pleasure Boat Studio of Seattle. Cervena Barva Press in Somerville, Massachusetts, is expected to publish his poetry collection. True Hercules and Don Madres will publish This Is How Good You Are, New and Selected Poems. So, welcome, Michael Daly.
Thank you. Thank you.
So why don't we just start this off? You just go ahead and read something.
I'd like to start with the first poem that would be in the new and selected collection that you mentioned. And it's one of the lead-off poems from my first book, The Straits. The title is Vocation. The moon is in the window. Now is the time to go. Gray light fills the clearing and spills under the cedars. The straits reach to islands I've never seen except as lights. The faded cities of the sun are written into the water. Black ships pass under the moon and no one notices. Houses and oil to the new world. Alaskan caribou browse and quiver at a far-off sound. How many dreams it takes to know who hunts the wild bird. So I should say that The Straits, the title of that book, refers to the Straits of Juan de Fuca, which of course is now part of the Salish Sea. The Salish Sea is a name that was given to that body of water that includes several straits of Juan de Fuca, the Harrow Straits, and others. I think it was given, I'm not sure, possibly in the last 5 years, maybe even 10 years, in the Salish Sea.
I was wondering how the Alaskan caribou got into the poem.
Well, I suppose it's only in my imagination that as I was watching freighters pass along the straits going out towards the mouth of the straits, that would be towards the Pacific, I imagined that those freighters were heading to Alaska and the caribou were up there.
Well, they certainly are. I can tell you that from firsthand experience. I notice that you incorporate imagery from the Pacific Northwest. It almost seems like very carefully into all of your poetry that I've seen.
Yeah, I believe in trying to ground whatever is coming about in the course of writing a poem, to ground it in place. And in this place where I've lived for, well, almost 50 years, you know, there are other poems too that I guess I've written that have a lot of details that I've kind of culled from my memory of growing up in New England. And but I think that living here in the Northwest has helped me find a way to see and incorporate the visual and tactile world into those memories. I don't know that if I had grown up on the East Coast, I don't know if I would have been able to write with as much sensibility towards the physical world as I think I've tried to do in writing these poems.
Well, let's give them another example. Let's go ahead and read another one.
Okay. This is one that comes from living here in Skagit Valley. When I was a teacher at Mount Vernon High School, if I didn't take I-5, my drive was a back road. It was a beautiful drive, and you know, the kind of drive where you go to work and you really don't want to go to work. You just want to stay right there on that road. At any rate, at some point in my life, I started to listen to opera, which I don't do very often, and that managed to get into this poem called Aria. The tangled alder bow over the roadside and the swamp where they'll fall. The soprano in the pickup weeps an aria. Wrens outside chorus the sunrise in a loop of branches. Behind a bough of fir, a sudden cry. The wavy road sprays across a dark wood. A falling swoop, her tail feather flickers in my headlight, and the eagle glides, her body all wing, a wriggling rat dangled from a tine of copper talon, and in three slow strokes climbs from the highway to a lighted treetop. As a witness in the high-pitched opera of the vaulted grove, I became a man who kept white feathers, secret, all day. My heart is like that, laborer with its living captive, rippling under a cracked rib cage, singer bursting into morning light. Kind of an old poem for me. Well, I can't remember what year it was, but it has to be at least 25 years ago.
Did you collect eagle feathers, really?
Yeah, I have a few I've found over the years. I think the first time somebody gave me an eagle feather, I was living around Port Townsend in a teepee. And a good friend of mine came by for a visit and brought an eagle feather. And so I did put it up there. And another one that I still have, I found on the beach at Shai Shai one day where there were maybe five eagles altogether. I just found a few of them on the beach and decided I would take one with me.
My understanding is that it's actually against the law to own eagle feathers if you're not a Native American. Is that true?
I don't know, but I hope you don't give out my address.
Oh, I'm sure you're not the only one who has eagle feathers.
Of course, I could be wrong. I would rely on my own ignorance to say, well, maybe they're not eagles.
There we go. That's right. It's interesting how the eagle has come back to the Pacific Northwest. I don't know how many bald eagles there were around when you first got here. Growing up here, I didn't see them very often at all. And now it's fairly commonplace to see bald eagles. I saw one actually flying down a street in Tacoma being chased by a bunch of crows. And it's not unusual to see them around here or anywhere, you know. become a fairly common bird after almost disappearing.
Yeah, upriver from where I live, they come in droves up the Skagit River in the winter.
That's interesting what you did with the opera and that's what I've seen a lot in your writing is that here's a soprano and a pickup truck and you wonder if maybe the eagle is singing.
Seems like, you know, there's a similar drama that is portrayed in an opera. This seems like the dramas that we witness, at least, or we interpret that we witness in nature, there's kind of an echo there, you know, between what we see in art and what we see in the natural world. And it could be, you know, our tendency to anthropomorphize everything. On the other hand, it's a way, I think, of identifying with the kinds of struggles and overpowering that happens in nature, like in a poem like that.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting how we separate ourselves from the natural world. You talk about the natural world like, well, that, you know, that's not us, you know. Actually, I've thought of this for a long time, is that the planet is suffering from a human infestation. We're part of the natural world, whether we like it or not.
Oh yeah. I guess what I was thinking about there was the way that our tendency use art to portray what we see in the world that's outside of our houses or our cities or, you know, our human establishments does tend to separate, of course, the natural world from human nature. There is like this tendency to try to bring those two or that separateness together, maybe by looking at something that appears to be a drama, which is what I was doing in that poem, in the opera, and then transferring that onto what we see among other species, let's say.
Well, let's have another one of your poems.
Okay. I've liked this one for a while. It's a sonnet. It's just something that I witnessed. You know, very often, I think my wife and I do this. I imagine most people do. You see something happening with other people on the street, and you sort of create a kind of a story that may or may not really be going on there. And so this poem called Retired Jugglers is a fiction. It's interested me for years since I kind of witnessed this little scene. Retired jugglers, who are in fact two doctors who in med school practiced hours tossing balls and clubs and now delight two children in the park with striped, orange, freckled balls which explode out of the hands of one who looks all thumbs, while their dad, distracted, broods in the dark, autumn sun setting on their two small heads. They look a little rusty, but the kids, the hospital's youngest patients, believe scalpels or the arc of chance can't deprive them of this memory, a twilight laugh, and kind promises of at least a half-imagined life where watch and change and car keys drop just to find out who you are.
Well, that sounds like there's a story there somewhere, besides just being made up. Yeah. So I was wondering how the kids got in the hospital.
Well,
they're doctors. That's right. They're doctors who are juggling.
They were doctors, and they were juggling, entertaining these kids who, as I said, imagined or fictionalized that they were patients in the hospital. And their father was sitting there watching this. It would really warm my heart to know that there are doctors like this that would like to just sort of entertain their patients sometimes. I'm sure there are.
I know jugglers and I know doctors, but I've never seen the two intersect. That would probably be a good thing, you know, if a doctor was as good at entertaining as he was at taking care of people's bodies.
I think the thing that that struck me about whatever it was that I saw that prompted this poem was that the two people I saw who were juggling appeared to be doing it spontaneously. And that's why in the last lines, imagine life where watch and change and car keys drop just to find out who you are. It seemed to me that it was just a spur of the moment thing. And, somebody had balls, somebody just said, okay, I'll recover my juggling skills here on the grass for these kids. That's what struck me, I guess, in that moment.
Another thing about that poem is that doesn't have any place in particular in it. That could be any city in the world, probably.
Yeah,
which is a departure from a lot of your other work.
Right. In fact, I don't have very many poems that are seemingly set in cities, except, some of the ones that I wrote about growing up in the Boston area.
There's one of your poems that I found to be really intriguing, and that was the one, seemed like it was the death of a father and the emergency, the 911 people showed up and...
It's called Born With. Actually, it's one of my favorite poems to read. It's the title poem of this book, Born With.
Okay.
It's a story that my dad told me probably about a year before he died. He lived in a town called Hull, Massachusetts, which is right across from the Boston Lighthouse. And in the winter, he got some pretty violent storms because his house was up on a bluff. I guess the main detail I'd like to give away before I read it in the poem is that his upstairs window blew out with the wind and rain and snow that was coming in. And I think it was in the middle of the night. For him, it was, I think, one of the first times he ever called 911 and he got help. So this is called Born With. A year before he died, he called to praise, rare thing, firemen in the night. Heavy rubber gear, out of blowing snow, they tromped through his parlor. Up the crooked oak stair twisted four men, oxygen barrels strapped, first aid buckets, stretchers, Gatorade and water jugs, ham and egg sandwiches, extra frozen gloves, yellow dented flashlights swung from belts and suspenders. They came when he called out. 911, he announced, slow enough I couldn't miss. He hadn't ever called for help. Wouldn't let them in that time he fell in the kitchen, too weak to clutch the sink, lay 48 hours in stale beer, pungent urine. They came through the howler. Winter, a curse off ocean-driven snows, seawall crushed on, hour by iced hour, wave on top of wave. A spray on his porch so nonchalant was ironically gentle. In strobe light emergency, they bustled in. Burly, friendly guys, meaty fists, lugged, soot-pocked helmets. One of them bandy-legged with a worried smile. And up, he said, right up the steps to the bedroom. The old marriage bed emptied. He wouldn't have mentioned to them, much less to me, 30 years ago. The room itself draped in dust and salt rot, or that he slept in a room even noisier, howl of ghost winters, gurgled sea rash, wave toss, rock crack, a gaggle in the old man's dream. He awakened to either dead tooth wind or a mambo shark snout crash caved in his crackling lacework of a window, whistling a befouled round emptiness into his upstairs. And they got here, he went on to praise, in 10 minutes, hailing them as brave young men out on a night like this, brave men and kind, he raved, who almost never thought about the lives of others, no longer left his house. And in that bedroom, couldn't believe what they heard. stallion fury, screech of a window hole, whipped portraits and cobwebbed heirlooms off the walls, smashed a mirror, 7 years more bad luck. The invisible become real in a swarm of winds, wiped out 30 years of spiders. Twirled the arms off retired business suits, faded paisley ties, once crisp tongues chattered into snow, shoes flapped against bureau drawers yanked open, spilled medallions awarded in seventh grade. His own hero medals crammed so deep only death and the devil could disinter. Spun against the ceiling, a cyclone of yellowish papers, letters, in my self-indulgent hand 4 decades ago from New Jersey. He called that day to praise their genius, while the bandy-legged fireman crowed out loud relief. No blood on the floor, no stroke, no paddles to the heart. The other one, a big bruiser who spoke kindly, hoiked up the old queen mattress, launched it square inside the empty window dormer. Dug in a bucket with the orange screw gun hid under first aid poultices and fabricated a barricade out of bedboards and plastic tarpaulins against prolonged assault in blizzard hurricane, at least for now. They checked his pulse, strapped him to the portable blood machine, shone a beam in his insomniac eye, gave sandwiches and water bottles, and all 4 hoisted back onto the strobe-lit fire truck. Do they show up like this for anybody? Just showed up out here in misery and weather for you, Dad, in shatter. Your last agony's already begun. Firemen in the night, whose report on the call would read, wedged the bridal bed inside a window against the 100-year storm, because you needed them and spoke kindly to you when you needed them too, when you called. Well, thanks for asking for that. I haven't gotten a chance to read that very often.
I'm really glad that I asked for it, too. That's a really amazing piece of work. I think it's because it has so many different levels to it. You know, I think that the man who was in need and his attitude about the firemen who... It's funny that the firemen, you describe them only by their actions. You know, they did this and they did that. They didn't say anything really, except for he really felt like they were very kind to him. And
yeah.
But also the 100-year storm and the window. I love the spiders being wiped out and the paisley ties. As you were creating this intense drama, you were also having a bit of fun with the imagery that you were expressing.
I was trying to recall the room that he told me about. I wrote this many years after he died. He closed off the bedroom where he and my mother slept after they divorced. And he lived alone in the same house that they lived in. He moved to another bedroom that was upstairs, rather, as his bedroom. And he closed off that room. And I was trying to recall what was in there, which was basically, as I found out after he died, his entire life. And there's a small line in there about his hero medals, which were medals that he got in the Second World War or after the Second World War for his time in the service, all kind of buried in a bottom drawer with newspaper clippings and that sort of thing. And his various suits and ties that he never used anymore that were left over from when he worked. My imagining, too, about some of the things that were in there included some letters that I wrote to him when I was in college in New Jersey, and he stashed in some of those drawers, too. I don't really know, because, of course, he didn't tell me all the details about what kind of damage the wind did to that room, but I sort of poeticized, I suppose, about all the things that could be flying around in there when the wind stirred up.
Yeah, and you get an image of a man who's not functioning very well in the poem, yeah. Too.
He did everything he possibly could to stay in his house until the end of his life.
Yeah.
Suppose I should send a copy of that to the Hull Fire Department, which I never have done. Yeah,
I'd like to do that. Yeah, you never know. Maybe you'd sell a few books there.
if they were to pin it up on their bulletin board for a day or two, that would make me happy.
So there again, we wandered off to the East Coast from the West Coast. Why don't you pick out something that's westerly?
This other one, Coyotes on the Way to Somewhere Else. We used to hear more coyotes than we have in this past year or so, but several years ago, probably again in the 90s or maybe sometime before 2010, I just remember waking up in the middle of the night and stepping outside on my porch, and I heard these coyotes just kind of going crazy, kind of down in a valley down below my house. And it struck me as an oral rendition of what Mark Tobey was doing with white writing and other famous Northwest artists. So I have a little epigraph from Mark Tobey at the beginning of this. The name of the poem is Coyotes on the Way to Somewhere Else. A few streaks of white, some blue streaks, looked like a distorted nest. It bothered me. Mark Tobey. White writing streaks a pitch black backdrop, moonless mid-September nights, like clockwork after 10, a tangled net of song, stitched thread of dappled tones. Perhaps they're down among the poplars, where a curling creek emerges, and in March bloated frogs boast. Once I heard them cackle there at 4 a.m., a tribe passing through the pasture, laughing all the way to somewhere else, shy version of creator recurrent as grass, shotgun useless against sound dancing, firefly dervish that happy.
Coyotes are always interesting to me, that they're one of those creatures that always survive. They're everywhere. People talk about spotting coyotes here in the city, and in certain parts of the country, they're even more common. Of course, out where you live, I'm sure you see a coyote now and then. But they do a pretty good job of hiding, don't they?
Yeah. I still hear them every now and then, but we used to actually see them more around here. My house is, as I said, it's on a dead end, but we're surrounded by forest. And so, you know, we see deer. And years ago, I remember watching a couple of coyote emerge from the woods chasing a couple of deer, or looking after a couple of deer. And they saw me on the porch and they turned around and went the other direction. But I think they've become kind of an urban animal in a lot of ways.
Well, when I was growing up, I remember people talking about shooting coyotes, and it was like they were an animal that was a pest. Of course, a lot of people had chickens. Coyotes and foxes are notorious for raiding the chicken coop.
Right, and taking away small pets.
Which books would you most like to have mentioned?
Well, there's two forthcoming. The one is the novel, and it's pronounced Telemachus. It'll be out by March from Pleasure Boat Studio. The other is called Reinhabited, New and Selected Poems, coming out from Dos Madres Press in Ohio.
And where will people be able to get those?
Those books are available from the publishers. Dos Madres and Pleasure Boat Studio have websites. They're available on Amazon and I think Small Press Distribution. Anybody who goes to a local bookstore and asks for those titles, the bookstores can order them from their distributor.
Okay. Thank you for being on Sound Poetry today. I'm Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore, And we've been listening to Michael Daly, an anachordist poet and the publisher of Empty Bowl Press. Thanks a lot, Michael, for doing this with us.
Well, thank you very much.